All right, there will be bourbon. Mr. Lafayette Lee returns for third time, right? Third time, I think,
Yeah.
maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is the third time, so it's the charm,
It is. Well, it should be. And that kind of is in sync with the three names we have for you now. We have Clarinet Flea that you provided. We have the Bayonet B, and it all aligns with Lafayette Lee. And that is now. All right, and you have your Substack, right, where people can read and follow you on there. Obviously, big on the X app, Twitter, as everyone knows it on there at the Partisan O account. And you're also a contributing editor for IM1776, right? Have you
Yep,
got
that's
anything else?
right. Yeah, no, that's perfect.
Got it all. Okay. And as tonight, or as always, tonight will be fueled by America's native spirit. And recently was in Kentucky, found something new. It's been getting a lot of hype, so I figured I'd check it out because it's from Missouri, right? First bourbon I've ever seen from Missouri. It is from the Holiday Distillery. It is a 6-year bottled and bond red wheat bourbon, and it is very, very good. So whatever they're doing in Missouri, keep it up. So there you go. All right, brother. So originally this started, right? I was just like, okay, I want to get Lee back on because good for business, number one. But B, also, you, I think, can provide a lot more nuance given your background into just what's kind of unfolding. Because I think you would be hard pressed to just talk to the average person or someone our age, right? Or a GWAT veteran or someone in that time period, age wise, who's just felt like things haven't really just sped up culturally. Very, very quickly, I'd say in the last 5 to 10 years. Does that sound fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why do you think that is? Why the pedal to the metal type of reaction from our society and politics and just everything culturally? Why is it sped up so much from, I mean, even just the time since we were in high school, which wasn't in theory that long ago.
Yeah. Well, there's a few things going on. One thing that I'll hit on, all this is intersecting with politics, right? I think, we came of age in a time, I'm sure it was like this, when you were young, where you were growing up, but it's like if you were a dweeb, you would talk about politics. Like if you know what I mean, like you were on the debate team or something. It was like most people, it wasn't something you would lead with, like if you were trying to impress a girl, you wouldn't talk about politics, right? Like that was normal, right? Back in the day. You're a little strange. Now it's like all anybody can talk about. And I don't know how,
Interesting
things
point.
are on the Zoomer side of things with their, but it seems that they have been propagandized a lot more than we were. So politics is a lot more top of mind for young people coming up. So it's much more present in their lives. Whether or not they really care about it, I don't know. But the point is that politics are really, we're just swimming in it. But it's But the distinction I want to make is it's not real politics. Okay. This is it's as many people on the internet will say, they'll always like call something fake or gay. It's kind of like our silly way of saying that things aren't really what they seem. And when it comes to this mass politics that we're swimming in and all the propaganda and that's really kind of pushing people to feel constantly like they're on the brink of some kind of catastrophe. And that's for people on the right and the left all at the same time. It's not real politics though. Politics are people advocating for their interests, coming, finding a medium to compromise, to debate, to serve their interests in some way, right? Like on some kind of forum, political forum. And we aren't really doing that if you think about it. What we're doing is we're being inundated with information constantly that piques our interest and makes us get really upset, but we aren't really accomplishing anything, And I'm saying this, full disclosure, I'm not on Twitter and I talk about this stuff all the time, but am I engaging in politics? So I'm raising a political consciousness, but I'm not actually engaging in politics. And why I'm bringing this up is that one of the things that is made this so difficult is that politics have been stripped from ordinary people in a way that our, prior generations would be appalled at, is that even though we're swimming in politics, we're not actually able to participate. We are given this kind of paltry a substitute for real politics. It looks and feels like politics, but it's like fake meat, right? It's like this lab-grown meat. It's not actually real. And it's causing problems. And one of the reasons for that is that the power in our country, which was in at least in theory for a very long time, but in practice as well, power was distributed and kind of, separated, right? And that power was something that at even like a local level I could exercise. And I think that if we really sit down and think about it and cut through the BS, we'll realize that we have been kind of pushed outside of the political realm. And because of that, I think it has caused a lot of power to amass in a very narrow space. And it can basically move society around as it sees fit. And there's no way to contest that. And so when you control so much real estate, it can be very unwieldy and difficult, especially as you're going through, when you have a very narrow group of people making decisions that impact the entire country or the rest of the world, and they are often irresponsible decisions or destructive decisions, and there's no way to check that power, it can make things incredibly chaotic. And I think that's what we're going through right now.
You said the youth, they're getting propagandized. And the first thing I thought of is obviously my daughter, right? So she'll graduate high school next week. And she, like, there's no opinions really on any of this stuff that are very different from what you and I probably have. I all throughout the last 2 years, she's shown me all the stuff that they talk about, with their government class or any of those things. Like, and I'm not seeing any of the stuff that we're seeing kind of play out on various college campuses across the country. So the propaganda element, I thought back to when, because, my undergrad was political science, and I didn't go back to college until the second time, until years after I had joined the army before I finally went back to finish once I left the first time. And I did political science, and I never, out of all of the classes that I took in political science, I never remember that much centering around Israel and Palestine. Like, it just wasn't a huge portion of the curriculum. And so I'm basing that off of really the last 10 to 12 years. So if it wasn't that big of an part of my school, and I'm not seeing it in a totally different state political system within that state with my daughter in high school, I'm trying to figure out and nail down just where is it coming from then? And how did it get so, I guess, widespread in the entire opposite direction? Does that make sense?
No, yeah, no, it does. Here, I'll kind of give you my see what you think about this.
Okay.
This is my read on it, and I could be wrong, right? I'm just looking at this from Lafayette Lee's perch over here. But I think a few things are going on here. Okay, so Israel, and we have a very peculiar relationship with Israel, and we've had one for a long time. There is, and without going into all the history, there are aspects of our relationship that I think have caused they've been beneficial in many ways, but they've also been detrimental to both parties. Okay, so this is the thing, is that when people are looking at this situation right now, it's not just like there's one side of the fence that feels Israel has too much influence on U.S. foreign policy, would be like, don't you see, like, Israel's calling all the shots, and Washington's just kowtowing to Israel, and that's not really what's happening.
No, I think it's a very emotional response.
Yeah, and you're really, and like what it is too is like Washington's calling a lot of shots in the Middle East right now, whether people realize that or not. And what's ending up happening is that you're kind of having, you have a situation where nobody is going to be very happy by the end of this, at least nations with interests, okay? And it's kind of like a lose-lose. It's a lose-lose for nations, and it's kind of like a win-win for factions and elements within those nations. And so like the situation that's really difficult though, that I think is the underlying political problem that's going on, is that the old guard, within the Democratic and Republican parties, the old guard within the foreign policy establishment, had a relationship with Israel that the new incoming power elite, that they're having kind of a bit of a power struggle for control of the foreign policy establishment, for control of elements of U.S. government and the political parties, namely the Democrats. The insurgent group is very different. They're more critical of Israel, much more open to opening relations with Iran, right? And what you're seeing is you're seeing a power struggle between the old guard and this new kind of really like the person who ushered this in, I would say, would be Obama, is that you kind of have this new faction that's contesting a lot of this old real estate. And it's causing a lot of chaos in Washington and then obviously in the rest of the world. And why I'm really interested in this is because what you're seeing in the streets is astroturfed, like big time. Like there are students that are out there that have cared about this for a long time. I'm not trying to say there aren't,
right?
But the muscle that you're seeing, the coordination, that is astroturf big time. Like we can see this playing out in the streets. The organization is very well done. And I think, like, you know, people will look at tents and think that that means that it's coordinated, but there's a lot more going on. And what you're seeing is that there are billionaires and NGOs and nonprofits that are funding the protests while at the same time pressuring the other side in certain ways. And you have figures like a George Soros, who is kind of playing both sides of this. And that's what's really interesting, is so you're seeing this, you're really seeing pressure being put internally in Israel, but also internally in the United States. And I don't know how this is going to play out. I do think one thing that if I were Israeli, I'd be very worried about this changing sentiment towards Israel. The older people and then your bread and butter Republicans are very friendly to Israel, but like the Democratic Party is going through a sea change in sentiment towards Israel right now. And the younger generation, which tends to flood into the Democratic Party, they have a very different perspective on Israel than their parents and grandparents did. And I think that that's going to have severe repercussions in the future. And so my prediction is, I think Israel will probably, by the end of this, Israel is going to reevaluate its relationship with the United States. And I think the United States will reevaluate its relationship with Israel. And I think it's going to be a lot less collaborative than it has been in the past.
So to that, I would just say, all of these people who you just described, what did they think the reaction from Israel was going to be after October 7th?
Well, I don't think they think about it quite like, you know, I don't
they
think
know that happened, right? Like they didn't, this isn't just like organically all of a sudden Israel bad, like, okay.
Right.
You know what precipitated this?
Yeah. Well, okay. So there are some people that I would say, like, my personal orientation is I am like America first, put America first. Then I have purposefully tried to avoid getting too involved in this because I want to keep the focus here. Yeah, right. And I also understand, like, on the ground, as you and I know, this stuff is complicated, and there are like humanitarian concerns, which I have opinions on, but at the same time, like, it's just, I'm trying to focus here. So, there are people who are very critical of the way Israel's conducted this. And I think that some of them are definitely coming from a very a good place, and I respect their opinions immensely. And so I will say that. But the vast majority of people that you see on college campuses and like this astroturf reaction, I mean, it's pretty obvious what it is. I mean, this is like a repeat of the 2020 riots, which were ostensibly in support of Black Lives. And it's almost like they just changed uniforms and now they're critical of settler colonialism with Israel, you know, but like they're critical of settler colonialism in the United States. So it's like, I think this is being seen by the left as an opportunity. And, you know, that pro-Palestinian movement has always been more friendly to the far left fringe in the United States and in the world. And so they've always had kind of this relationship, and then it's just come back together, and it's, you know, it's being funded by a lot of different organizations that I, you know, we could always talk about what we think,
Yeah.
why we think they're doing that. But the point is that these are not people that are thinking about realpolitik. You know, these are not people that are looking at Israel's situation and trying to understand, like, what would a state do when they have this problem, right? Most of the people that are in the streets are using this as an opportunity, just like in the 2020 riots, in my opinion.
And that's because I can, and I think you brought it up, there's humanitarian issues, you know, not just in Palestine, but also in Israel. Like, there's humanitarian issues at the core of this that I think are worth discussing. And, you know, I've always said that I feel for the Palestinian people, but at what point do you hold the leadership of Hamas accountable? And why is there no call to bring the attention to that? Because what did they come into power? What, 2006, 2008, at some point? I think it was around that time.
Yeah, it was towards the end of Bush's term. He was actually, like, the United States actually kind of brokered those elections that propelled Hamas, which is an interesting story. But yeah, you know, I kind of look at it like this, like, similar to you, is that I will say that there's a lot that I am critical of in our relationship with Israel, and also with Israeli policy towards towards their neighbors in different ways. And then also, you know, and I'm not giving a free pass to their neighbors. I think it's a giant mess personally. And so it's difficult because I do not have an axe to grind against Israelis or Jews, right, broadly, because that's often that's how, you know, people that are critical, like, sometimes, you know, that's where the conversation goes. So, like, you know, putting that out there, I don't have an issue with Israelis or Jews. I loved Israel when I visited. Interesting history, but there is a difficult situation. It's difficult historically. It's difficult in terms of the relationship that the United States has with Israel. And I will add, I'm not just saying that it's difficult for, like, Israel is just a problem for the United States. The United States is a problem for Israel. And I don't think a lot of people that are very harshly critical of Israel understand that a lot of Israelis don't want this type of relationship with the United States. But, you know, because it doesn't always benefit their direct interests. Like, when the United States sends aids, and I don't think people realize this, is it's much more complex than most people realize. When the United States sends aid to Israel, there are strings attached. There's a reason why we want them to have to take that aid, because there are always strings attached. Washington is not powerless. And that's something that I think gets lost in the sauce in these discussions, is Washington is definitely much more of a shrewd player, and they throw their weight around a lot more effectively than most people give them credit. And so it can be complicated and difficult for Israel too. But from an American perspective, I look at this as, this is a very difficult situation. You have to be incredibly shrewd in how you digest information from both sides of this equation. You know, I'll see things, like, I will see things that, in like, for Americans to do would be considered a war crime, right? But then I'll also I'll also look at the situation where, like, this is war, and this is a different kind of enemy, as we know, right?
Mm-hmm.
From the Middle East.
Yeah.
And so I try to be very cautious in analyzing these and being too harsh on some of this, because it's very difficult, and I would not know how to solve this problem. My solution really is, we really need to step back from the Middle East a lot. I think that's an area that has not been very good for us to be so involved and invested. And I think Israel would also benefit. If people are worried about Israel, I think Israel would actually be better off having a little more distance between it and the United States. I think they would be happier, and I think we would be happier. But I think this problem will get solved in Gaza. I think they're going to take care of it, but I think it's going to be very difficult for them in the future. This has been very bad for optics. Like, whether, and I'm not taking, some people might get mad at me for saying this, because I'm not, like I said, I'm not, like, putting my dog in this fight here. I'm just trying to be objective. This has been, even when, like, there's a lot of I hate using the word, but there's a lot of disinformation propaganda flying around, you know, between various parties with this. But This is one of those situations that I think Israel has lost the propaganda war, and that's going to be really costly in the long run. So I think that Israel has a lot of hard decisions to make coming out of this. They're going to take care of what they need to take care of, and they're going to come out of this, but it's going to be very difficult to navigate this politically. And I think they've had to learn a lot of things in real time, like militarily too. I mean, they were not prepared for this. And I think they're going to have to make a lot of hard decisions on how they're going to overcome these challenges and survive in such a tough neighborhood that where the world has been really polarized against them.
Let's go back to where I originally I mentioned. I think when we, I don't know if it was in before we started recording or not, but when I reached out to you a few weeks ago, because what precipitated that was seeing the latest vote, but this time cheerleading with Ukraine flags on the House floor. What did you think when you saw that?
Yeah, it horrified me. I mean, I'm not surprised because I do not think highly of any of the people there, but it was hard to watch. I've just had a very bad taste in my mouth for Republicans and Democrats on the Hill for quite a long time now. And I felt like that was a betrayal of the American people. I can't believe that I would see foreign flags being flown like that, especially when it's an issue which the American people have almost zero input in,
Right.
right?
Like, no one's voted, no one's asked for anything, no one's called for sacrifice, no one's called for some support. This isn't like a repeat of just like this national case being made to the UN or anything like we saw with Colin Powell before we went into Iraq. Nothing. It's just, yeah, we're just gonna keep doing this.
And I mean, this goes back to that earlier point, is that I think Americans are realizing that consent of the governed, which is should undergird our system of government, is not really a thing. It's kind of an illusion. And I don't say that to try to be a blackpiller. I mean, it's just I think it's obvious. And this is one of those tough spots that we kind of have to, as Americans, we have to wake up and realize where we're at. And I think it's important that we don't lose, like when we start seeing how little power we do have, that we don't become despairing and give up. I mean, there's still a fight to be had, but I think that this whole Ukraine Israel business has really shown people that foreign policy is the American people have almost zero input or influence over our foreign policy. And it's a really tragic thing because looking at the situation with Ukraine, I mean, it's just this did not have to be this way. And this is Washington wants this, and it's going. I look at this similar to Vietnam that there are other objectives that are at play here that are at stake, and those objectives will be accomplished, but they have very little to do with whether Ukraine remains like the people of Ukraine remain sovereign or whether the people of Ukraine survive as like they're like a real ethnos, like they've killed so many Ukrainians in this conflict. And I don't think Ukraine will ever look the same again after this. And I think that there's a real sad story there.
Are you surprised it's gone on this long? Like, is Russia just slow playing it, or what do you think the.
I when Russia invaded, there were a lot of people that thought Russia was just going to roll up Ukraine, and I thought that was pretty laughable because you have this country the size of Texas, it's enormous, and Ukrainians are tough people. I have a lot of respect for them. I served with a few Ukrainians, and they were some of the toughest guys I'd ever met. So these are guys who are willing to fight, and I don't know how many of those original Ukrainians that went into it when this started are still around, but I think Russia knows that it can get most of what it wants without having to, like, it's taking its time because it's almost like you're it's this is a long fight, and even though Russia's taken some bloody noses and it's had some knocks, they just know that as long as they keep the maul going, they're going to get everything they want, and they're not going to have to take too much unnecessary risk. And I think that that's I do think there's other things at play, right? It's very precarious because of the, with NATO. So I don't know where that's going to go, but I do know that Russia has come out of this looking much better than it did almost going in. They've obviously lost life, but they've kind of restored their military industrial capacity. They've come out of this pretty well by they've drawn a lot closer to China, and there's kind of been this power shift that I'm sure they've looked favorably to. So it's like, I don't know, in the grand scheme of things, I think Russia's going to come out of this looking pretty good, and Ukraine will never be really free again, and that's something that's very sad, but this is kind of how this is how it works, right? Like, I think Washington saw an opportunity, and so
I just, it's hard for me to see why though, because I see what you're saying, but let's think back of when this started. Like it's right on the back of our performance in the Afghanistan withdrawal, right? This becomes the next big, wait, well, what's that meme where it's like over, like look over here now, right? Like we've got this going on, and that kind of did what it did in the short term. It distracted everyone to the big new shiny object. And I mean, wasn't it, it didn't, like, to me, it reminded me once I went back and saw how, like, the reporting was. Because when it was going on, obviously, I was over there and I didn't really see any of this stuff. But remember, like, in the early days of this, as soon as Russia invaded, you started getting all these, like, myths being in these legends coming about, like, just like the Jessica Lynch thing. Like Jessica Lynch went out guns blazing before and killed all these Iraqis before she was taken hostage. And well, that didn't happen. And then Pat Tillman is like the greatest soldier we've ever seen, and he was fighting until the end. And well, it was actually not what took place. And you had all these propaganda pieces very early on that have kind of gone by the wayside. And I think a lot of them were expertly trolled by us, not us, but just people on Twitter. Remember, what was it, the fighter pilot apparently, like, of Ukraine had, is shooting down all these Russian planes and all, and I think someone said,
The
yeah,
ghost of Kiev.
Netflix special, yeah, the Netflix special is played by like a black transgender, but it's just like the trolling that went on about all these stories that came out, and they just kind of went away because I think they realized, like, I feel like the propaganda wing is still operating in a very different world than the social media era we live in, to where things are either debunked instantly or very quickly, or just on their face, not even accepted anymore. Which is good and bad, right? Because that kind of puts us into what I think I've said a few times before, is like we're so jaded about everything. Like we don't believe anything good. Nah, it can't be bad. Of course it's bad. Like, right? Like there's no more. Like, where's the hope? Where's Obama with hope and change? Like, come on.
Oh, I know. Well, and it's we're coming we're we entered into this on the heels of the Afghanistan withdrawal, and that was horrifying, and then a giant mess. And I think this all goes to show how decrepit our foreign policy establishment is, how disconnected from their own countrymen that they are. I said recently, Washington feels like a foreign capital, and I believe that. It does not feel like it represents America as I know it at all. And it's interesting that all these people that you and I would call failures, right, over the past 20 years are really in the driver's seat on this war, these proxy wars, And so I don't expect a much different outcome. There will be no real strategy to this. I mean, I love how, like, the argument is, well, we're degrading Russia's, like, capacity, and we're grinding through their men, and we could force regime change. I mean, this sounds so much like what we heard for 20 years with all of the different despots that we were going up against, and they're all Hitler, it's 1938. I mean, it's like so lazy, and it's just getting recycled. And what blows me away is, like, yes, I'm not really shocked that they're talking this way because they know nothing else, because there's ulterior motives to all of these things, as we know, right? There is another game, there's a game plan within this, and the propaganda is just kind of meant for mass consumption and for, you know, for your foreign policy elites and the blowhards to talk about. But there's something else going on. But what kills me is when I run into other Americans that should know better, and they're so enthusiastic about these talking points that I know are complete BS. It's just hard for me to stomach because, you know, my big concern is I want the American people to be sovereign. I want this country to remain sovereign. I want the people, the consent of the governed, to be worth a damn, you know? And when I hear these, my fellow Americans repeat this nonsense, it's really, you know, it's really hard to hear. It's hard for me to, you know, recognize that, well, a lot of these people don't mind the status quo. Like, they don't mind being hoodwinked constantly and deceived. I just think that's really sad. I mean, I don't know what to make of it. It's really difficult. I think that this, I think by the end of this, this is what's going to happen is Ukraine is going to, there's going to have to be a peace deal. And, you know, we're looking at thousands and thousands and thousands of dead men. You know, it's going to demographically change Ukraine forever. It's probably going to require foreign workers to be able to keep their economy afloat. There's going to be all
a lot
this,
of those.
Oh yeah. Well, right. But then out comes the stories, right? Just like in Afghanistan, like with Karzai and all of his, you know, friends and stuff and family members. But we're going to hear all these stories of corruption. And then you're going to hear about all these oligarchs, these Ukrainian oligarchs and their kids. They got them off the hook. And, you know, they were off yachting while all their countrymen were being.
We already are hearing that, aren't we? Like,
yeah, right. Like, right. It's trickling out. Exactly. It's
already seen it.
And you're going to hear about all these American weapons and things being sold. And you know, you're going to hear all these horrifying things. And then what's going to happen is all the people that were cheerleading this are going to either pretend it's not happening, or they're going to blame it on the wrong party, right? You're going to get a Tom Nichols piece, how this is actually the American people's fault, you know, that whole thing. And I mean, it disgusts me, but it's tough. I don't know how you dislodge these guys. I mean, obviously, like, being a failure doesn't matter. And so it's really wretched. And it's a horrible thing because I think in the long run, like I said, I think Ukraine's going to look entirely different after this. Yeah. I think that is just fine for the parties that are driving the bus on this, because there's a lot of, like, rich farmland. There's a lot of resources. And I think there's going to be a deal, and there's going to be a lot of people that will swoop in like vultures and take advantage of it. And those of us who remind them that this all came at the cost of a whole, you know, generation of Ukrainians, they're going to tell us to shut up. So it's a real bleak thing. It's sad.
So I know you said that you believe there will ultimately be a peace deal, but do you think it could get to I don't know if it would get to a point, or if it just gets to, I guess, a political point, I guess the question would be, to where you would see NATO involvement there, or even American involvement outside of what we already believe is going on.
I mean, it's possible. Everything I see, it's possible, right? I don't know if that's what they really want. That's quite a thing. But I really don't know. I can't read these people sometimes. I think they're crazy. I shouldn't say they're crazy. They're not crazy, but they're very flippant about blood and treasure that they use to get what they want. Let's put it that way. And that's hard to watch. I mean, it's possible. I think that the most likely outcome will be some kind of peace deal. I mean, Lutwak was talking about having kind of like a plebiscite, allowing parts of Ukraine to leave, keeping the majority of Ukraine intact, and then, you know, calling off the dogs and having some kind of deal. I'm sure that the United States will keep a huge footprint there. We'll have a big intelligence presence there. And then obviously, like, I think there will be a lot of international business and arms dealing and all that kind of stuff. And there will be a lot of contracting and all that sort of a thing. And there will be people scooping up that land and making a lot of money. And I think that's probably what's going to end up happening to that country. But they aren't going to be free again, at least as we know it. But, you know, that's kind of the story of all these places. I mean, it's just incredible. You look at, like, a place like Iraq and your generation of GWAP vets, I've always said this, there's, like, kind of two generations, and it's not really age, but it's chronological. It's like the guys that went into Iraq in the early days, that early half, and Afghanistan too, kind of a different breed. I mean, really, the army was, it got a lot softer and it kind of changed priorities. The strategy became non-existent, but like there was a real thing going on in Iraq, and you know, there are a lot of you guys were there during really tough times. And it's just when I look at what you guys did over there, and then I real, you know, when we see that Iraq is basically an Iranian proxy state, and it highly corrupt, hates the United States. And you know, it's like one of these things where it's like, you know, if you actually look at that, it's pretty bleak. And I think we're gonna 20 years down the road, we're gonna look at what is Ukraine in 20 years, and it's gonna be something really tragic, similar to that.
Yeah, that's why I keep like we don't we're not winning anything. Like we're not getting
Right.
any return on the investment at all. Like if this
Well,
was
as a nation, right? But who gets the return on investment
well,
is Washington, right? And like I used the example of Vietnam before, but this is kind of like an interesting thing to think about. Like Vietnam was a loss, so it's an L on the scoreboard. But you know, Vietnam was won by the military, and I don't think people think about it this way, but they should. What started off with bureaucrats, spooks, and other, you know, Washington creatures, the military had to come in and do the fighting. And they came in and did the fighting, and they killed a lot of bad guys, and they beat them down. I mean, I don't think people realize this. They beat them down and kind of won. Okay. And but there was a political objective that was being purported to the American people that wasn't quite achieved, but Washington still achieved other objectives. There was a lot that we learned, like there was a lot that Washington benefited from being in Vietnam. What they lost was the respect and admiration of the American people. There was a lot of you know, people were very frustrated with the way that it was going. A lot of people got killed. But if you look at a creature of Washington, that doesn't really matter that much, right? There are other objectives that are being met, and when those objectives are met, it's considered a success. There's a lot of people within the intelligence community back in that day that considered Vietnam a great success, you know. And even after the fact, I want to say William Colby probably, I might be wrong on that, but you know, he considered it a big success. They achieved the goals they wanted there, and so like I think that the problem is like we are Americans, and so we look at this like we're patriots. We look at it like, what's this doing for the nation, the American people, our safety and security, our prosperity? And like those things are all lower on the priority list for Washington. And I think that's the thing I'm talking about when it comes to consent and some of these old American principles. That's the rub. That's the tough part, is we've got a Washington that is reckless and does what it wants, achieves its own objectives, enriches itself. But the American people are always left with the tab, and not only are they left with the blood and treasure tab, but they're also left with the guilt. It's like Washington does not take on the guilt. They don't admit their failures, you know, or if they do, it's very like inadequate. But it always gets passed, just like that Tom Nichols article. It's always America's fault. It's Americans' fault. It's American culture. It's the type, the generation of people. It, you know, Vietnam got pinned on the draftees, and like. But it's always obfuscation. It's Washington's fault. It was their failure, but it gets pinned on America.
You bring up Washington, which I because I wanted to eventually pivot to this article from Eric Prince about being too big to win. But is America too big to have a not too big to, a too big to influence, I would say. Are they just too big because there's just too many of us doing too many of our things that are, you know, we're too concerned with our own lives to really rein in Washington. So we're just kind of like, whatever.
Well,
Not really
I,
affecting the average American, right?
right. Well, and
So.
I mean, this all goes back to that consent. So it's like we have democratic mechanisms, ideally, that are supposed to allow the American people to control their government. Like we believe in the principle of self-government. That's like the whole point, right? But I think, again, I'm not trying to blackpill the audience, but this is just the way it is. We don't have, there isn't, the American people are not sovereign. Washington is sovereign. The bureaucracy is sovereign, meaning they are the ones who can make the exception to the rule. The American people cannot do that. And that is not how it should be. right, by our own founding ideals and documents and principles, but that's what it's become. And so we have this real issue here where the democratic mechanisms which we used in the past to rein in reckless power, arbitrary power, or tyrannical power, as like someone like Jefferson would say, those have been eroded or taken out of our hands. So if you think about this, like on a just kind of like, let's look at the bureaucracy, most like legislation that we would think should be happening within the halls of Congress is happening within departments, agencies, offices, working groups that are not at all accountable to the American people. We do not know what they're talking about. We don't know what they're working on. They just get snuck into a bill or a budget and then they get passed. So like legislating, as we understand it, is happening all the time, but it's happening within an insular, incomprehensible government system. And so it's not democratic. I mean, we're not a democracy, but it's not democratic either. And so there's not a way for the American people to check that. Now, the closest thing was the American people voting for an outsider. So somebody like a Trump is a good example of this. I interpret Trump's rise, whether people like him or don't, I interpret Trump's rise as a lot of the American people trying to find a way to rein in Washington, to put their guy at the table, right? And we saw what happened there. Washington recoiled against Trump, and there was, you know, that we're seeing that play out right now, this fight between the two. So that's the problem. Where I think Eric Prince is coming from, which I think is he really nails it with his article on IM-1776, is he's talking about this incomprehensible thing, you know, the Beltway and so on. Like it's become so big, sprawling, and invasive, it really can't win. It can't have a decisive strategy. You know, it's more like a looting scheme. You know, it's almost like a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
And so the things that we want to see as the American people, as citizens, like winning wars, protecting our sovereignty, protecting our borders, making sure that we can project power and protect our interests, like this thing can't really accomplish it. It's like this many-headed hydra that is unwieldy and does what it wants. And, you know, we're just along for the ride. And so I think that, you know, I like his article because I think he's saying like, we really have to think radically different. This thing has got to change. My opinion is it's going to take the whole country down with it unless it gets stopped. Because it's just, there's too much resources, blood, and the political problems that it creates is so much more than the benefits that it's getting. It's not making the world safer. It doesn't protect America, really.
Yeah.
It serves a variety of interests that often have nothing to do with what the American people as a whole deserve or want. So I agree with him. I think we need radical change. We need people that can think outside the box, and we need decisive leadership. You know, we can't have decisive leaders. They get torn down or taken away from us. They get bogged down with problems before they're able to really lead or govern. And there's no real governance. So we're kind of in this vacuum, this power vacuum that needs to be filled, but hopefully by somebody who can be a decisive leader rather than just layers upon layers of this incomprehensible bureaucracy.
With these growing and, well, they're not shrinking, and I'm sure, you know, within a month from now, we'll be talking about somewhere else that we want to go. Do you think it's a very real possibility to see a return to the draft in our lifetime?
So I don't think it. Okay. So I think there's a lot of really, there's many compelling arguments as why the draft would be a good thing. And I definitely take those seriously. I think though that the draft would destroy the country. I think they know this. So like in Vietnam, it about tore the country apart. And I think that now it would even be worse because the American people are not the same people that we had in the 60s. You know, it's like, these are kids who were being raised by World War II veterans. You know, these were very different times. Like we always make fun of the boomers, but the boomers were a lot different. And like, I
they
think
won.
Yeah, they did. But so to me, it's like the draft would tear absolute. It could topple this regime. So I think for them, I think that's not really an option that they want to go to. But I do think like thinking radically different, right? Decisive leadership. I think that an idea of national service of some kind, forcing the Beltway and their kids to have skin in the game would change things for the better. We do not like the people that were doing the fighting and dying in during the 20 years of war back there. By and large, this was like the backbone of America. This was not the kind of people that you're finding protesting on Columbia's campus right now, and so and those are and the, that cohort of people are going to be in charge. They're going to be telling the GWAT veterans what to do. And so this is where I think there's a huge disconnect. In the past, World War II, I mean, man, if you think about it, you have like Nathan Bedford Forrest's like grandson was like one of the first to die in the war. And then you had like Teddy Roosevelt's like son fought in World War II. It's like you had the elite, these old
Well, that's why
families.
I admired the Kennedys now more than ever, because
Oh yeah.
at least they actually died for this country.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like you can go down the list and there's this generation of people that served and they became presidents and they became diplomats and they did other things. And today, like how many people can you really point to? Like when was the last time that we had a president who really served? Like really, like it would be, I mean, George H.W. Bush would probably be the last. I mean, I know that like George W. Bush did that Air National Guard thing, but like
No, his dad was a his dad was legit.
yeah, legit.
He was a pilot in World War II, right? Before he did the CIA.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yep.
no,
And he
he's
got
been
shot down. And I mean, this is like,
so he's
but
probably
see, yeah, it just, I look at this and I'm like, man, we have all these GWAT vets. And I would like to see the GWAT generation step up. And there have been a lot, right? We have some in Congress and so on. But really, like, I would really like to see the GWAT vets. It's difficult, but we should be the ones thinking outside the box. We should be the ones picking up the baton that Eric Prince is kind of dangling and saying, like, this is the direction we need to go. We need to be creative with this because the country will not survive if we don't. And nobody knows that better than the guys who were involved over the last 20 years in these, in this, in this global war on terror.
How do we get that? Because I'm curious, because I agree with everything you're saying. And I know we've said this, more than one. I know we got Joe, we've got some others who've tried and done some stuff locally, but I just am concerned with the fact that we have so many of our generation of service members who are, which is largely to contribute to the recruiting crisis by not telling their children to serve anymore, to not encourage, nieces, nephews, and as well, or friends of their families to join. I wonder if we're withdrawing from service and government as well,
Yeah.
those things, because they
Oh,
feel
yeah.
like it's too big, right? Like, oh, what am I going to do? Right? Because that's what most people think. Like, oh, well, okay, well, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm one person. I go to, okay, I get elected to Congress. Okay, there's 534 other ones who are just doing whatever, or
Yeah.
not like me, or they're comfortable with the status quo because it benefits them at that point, right? And to go back to what you were saying about DC, and it is such a it is I don't think, and I know you do because I know you've been there and seen it, but I don't think most people realize what DC is until you get there, right? Like I had never been to Washington, DC in my life until I moved out here a few years ago. And just as you're trying to tell me that this is the capital of the greatest country ever to exist, I step over homeless people. There's encampments right around the corner from the White House. You've got mentally ill people running the metro stations, taking advantage of just everyday average people trying to go to work or do whatever. You have a constant stream of crime and violent crime from the youth of Washington, D.C. You have stores that don't even bother to stay open anymore and just close and move. You have nothing but the worst of society. Just outside the halls of Congress and the gates of the White House. And that's our capital. Like, that's the example we're supposed to follow. If for every other capital throughout this country and city, we're supposed to look to DC as some sort of model. How? How does anyone not see that as an issue? Even if you're not from there and you get elected and you come from some rural part of this country, do you not stand up and shout, what the F is this? This is what I got elected to? Like, I'm supposed to take this back and you know, trumpet this to my supporters as like, yeah, we got to do more of this. Like, why would anyone think DC is something to, I hate to say it, but yeah, there's some beautiful monuments and malls and some stuff that's there that's really cool to look at, but it's embarrassing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's this concept of anarcho-tyranny, which is that essentially that you have this kind of like this symbiotic relationship between anarchy and chaos and between tyrannical power. That, you know, they each justify one another, and it creates a really difficult situation for those of us in the middle, the law-abiding people that believe in, you know, being good neighbors and keeping the rules and working and paying our taxes. And, you know, we're this like invisible middle that gets really pinched by this. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because, you know, and I find myself torn on this because I've spent time on the Hill and I worked up there for a little bit. I don't know if I've ever actually admitted that on, you know, on a podcast, but I know a thing or two. I'm not like an old hand. Like, there are some people that you and I are friends with that have a lot more experience, but I have enough experience to have gotten a certain taste in my mouth. But it's the problem that I see is that, you know, Congress is really just, They have influence and they obviously have power, but the power that they have serves interests that are not mine. I mean, they really work for donors, and then themselves, you know, they get a cut of all this, but they don't really serve the country and they do not exercise power as has been, you know, as the Constitution envisions it, right? Or the Constitution allows for. It's become a very corrupt operation. And so running for Congress, I think you can make a difference. But in a lot of ways, Congress is so captured that even a lone congressman is so limited in what they can do from what we expect or want them to do. Now, I am not trying to say, like, I think a Joe Kent up there would be a huge win for the American people, and especially the people that are in his district. And there are some other people, Thomas Massie, I have an immense amount of respect for.
American.
But, you know, ultimately, I used to think that that was an area that I wanted to get more involved with. And now I'm really focused on the local because I can see it's my garden I can tend to. It's the sphere of influence I can maximize the most influence that I do have. And I think that that's the problem, is that I think a lot of GWAP, that, like, I think that the hard part is, like, I look at a guy like Joe, and Joe has to fight so hard against the right and the left. I mean, he's been attacked by both sides, and it's hard to watch because this is a guy who lost his wife in the service of their country. He's deployed how many times? He's a patriot. He's a gentleman. He's a great person. I mean,
read what they say about him, and we didn't know him like we do. We'd hate him.
Yeah. I mean, it's insane to me. I just can't believe a guy who has sacrificed so much for this country for the right reasons,
he's the enemy, that
he gets treated this way. Yeah, it's just, it's unreal. I mean, it really bothers me. I can't read those articles about him because it's just so off.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
It's like just these smear jobs. But, like, then you look at the vets that succeed a lot of the time. Not all of them are like this, but, like, you know, you get these guys that go with these, like, left-wing vet, you know, campaign organizations, so like Vote Vets or whatever,
right?
Like, these, a lot of these guys are just, you know, they have no loyalty to the American people at all. they're very cynical actors. It's obvious. They don't have like loyalty to the people they served with. They seem like running dogs to just the Democratic Party. They're just total partisans. And it's just so interesting to see the gulf between a person like Joe and how he gets maligned, and then these guys, like the Vindmans and such. And so
Okay.
that's tough to watch. I just,
Yeah.
it's hard to watch. And so I look at that and I'm like, well, I'd love to see more veterans in power, but at the same time, like, I think Joe's somebody you could trust with power. But then there's this whole cohort that we see on Mill Twitter. I would never trust those people having any power over me. You know what I mean? Making
Absolutely.
decisions for the country. And it's weird. I never met a lot of people like that when I served. I met
I
a
didn't either.
lot
No,
of great people.
even
But man,
now,
I've
to
met
this
some
day, I
brutal.
still think most of the people we come across are good people.
Yeah, I do too. But then when I jump on Twitter and see the Vote Vets guys and I see like the Vindmans, I'm like, man, where do they pick these guys up?
Is that maybe what we need to do, bro? Do you think we need to just run one big op and just all funnel in through the left and get elected that way? And then just surprise, just kidding.
I think a lot of people, no, I think you're onto something. I mean, I think that's why a lot of guys
I
do.
can pretend.
I think that's why a lot of guys do, because you kind of like, they do a great job of just of getting you elected, and then as long as you just take like the marching orders, like you're good to go. Like you're beyond reproach. You get the kid glove treatment. You can lash out and mock all the kind of the type of people you led when you were in. You can be horrible to, about, maggots and the deplorables, and you can just say all sorts of horrible stuff. You can claim you got a bronze star moving around your,
Yeah, hanging out at my computer.
yeah, that kind of stuff. But like at the same time, it's like some of these guys like Joe, I mean, they're really swimming upstream. But I do think, like I said, a guy like Joe Kent, if that guy got elected to any office, I have no doubt in my mind that he would make things a lot better. And so he's the kind of guy I'd love to see on the Hill. And so that he's the guy, the type who deserves it. So
Yeah.
I'm hoping he does well this time.
Give him even more credit for trying to do it where he's legit from, because he's already not really he didn't take the easy path, let's put it that way,
Right. Yeah.
right? He didn't
No,
move to
exactly.
like
DC or like
yeah let me
Northern
move to
Virginia.
yeah let me move to Florida, where most of the legislature's Republican. I can just pick a district and run and win, right? Like, he's like, no, I'm going home and I'm going to try and do what's best for District 3 in my state, and it's going to be a fight, right? And
Yeah.
to get rid of the people who are entrenched already in power to do that and then to come so close, which I think we both have our opinions on how that happened, but
Yeah. Yeah, I
yeah.
definitely have opinions, but yeah, I know you're right. And I think my if I could say anything to like veterans that are trying to do things, this has been my path, is look around you and tend to your own garden. And like there are so many positions in local government that go unfilled by good people that a veteran would just thrive in. And even if you live in a community you didn't grow up in, a lot of the time the locals trust you and they like you. Merely for the fact, and this is something we should always honor, right? But like merely for the fact that you serve the country, like you can be a bit of an outsider when you're a veteran. They get that. But there's so many things to get involved with and make your community more resilient, make it better. If we learned anything during the riots, which I know you and I talked during that time, but it's like being proactive and protecting your community and getting people working with your neighbors and having a network of people that you can trust. Helping your community to be more resilient against these forces that we're seeing unleashed. I mean, this is the perfect opportunity for veterans to get in the fight, and they don't have to go and sell out. They don't have to go sell their
Really
soul.
true. I think you brought up a good point about the local stuff, because I'm sure you're familiar with Drew, right? I won't say his last name because I know he's around here, but
Yeah.
he did the same thing. Like, he went and ran for local office around here and he won. And he's probably gonna be awesome at it. Like, I've in a chat with him where he talks a lot about some of the stuff he does. He clearly knows what he's talking about. He's very, very detail oriented, to the point where it's like, all right, I'm not reading all that. I But no, I don't mean that in a negative way. He's just very he's very dialed in, and he's a very smart guy, and
He takes it seriously.
it's he's going to be good for that. But I think the example of what you're making is that, he didn't seek everything at once. He picked what you just said, like, let me check out my garden. Let me see what I can do here to make it better. I think that's a good point, because I think maybe people get caught up, and that's a very American thing, unfortunately. It's culturally who we are. People want to be, a lot of people grow up just wanting to be stars, right? They want to be the actor that's in your profile picture right now, right? They want to be Hollywood, or they want to get famous. And when they think of politics, they only think Congress, Senate, President. They don't think like, oh, you know what? What about my local, I don't know, even if it is the tax collector. I don't know what, but maybe starting locally is something people would find more, not only an opportunity, but more of a benefit, because it's actually affecting where they actually live instead of a district that they're expected to vote one way no matter what when they get there anyway, right?
Yes. No, that's exactly right. And because it goes back to that thing that I said before about the mass politics. Oops, excuse me. Sorry, my computer's screaming at me. But
Oh, no, you're
it goes
fine.
back to that mass politics point that I made, that we're dealing with politics not being real. And so, a lot of these guys will go up and run for Congress or whatnot, and then we get upset because they seem like they don't listen to us at all, and that they are, making enriching themselves and so on. But like that's the temptation, because they don't really do anything. These guys rubber stamp everything the bureaucracy wants to do, and so like that's their job, and so they get paid doing it, and they put on a nice like little performance. Dan Crenshaw will go out and do his thing, and
Is anyone
but
more disappointing than him?
yeah, I was disappointed, but I never really trusted that guy, I'm gonna be honest.
Because he's a SEAL, he probably. Just
Well,
kidding.
I worked with SEALs on a couple trips,
I
and I
know. I
liked
mean,
them a lot.
that
I had a
article
lot of
hurt.
respect for
Prince
those guys.
was
I
sincere.
had good ones, but I will say that he always kind of came off as phony to me.
Okay.
And I'm not saying like, I didn't know anything more. I just didn't have a good gut feeling with him.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's sometimes all you need, right?
Yeah, but that's the thing, is like what veterans need to do, and some will be destined for Congress, like a Joe Kent, who I think could go there and serve his people well. But a lot of us, it's like, let's do real politics. Let's get in our communities. Let's go take our downtown alliance over, right? Like, let's put the priorities straight. Let's go run for town council. Let me get on the school board. Let me go coach Little League and be a positive influence on the people around me. Let's strengthen those boys and help them to grow up to be the kind of people we want, because this fight we're in is a generational fight. This will not be solved in a couple of years. This will take generations for us to get back to a place of sanity, in my opinion. It doesn't mean things can't improve, but I'm saying like we are very far down the road where all the easy choices had already been passed. So we have a lot of hard choices now. And there's no better place for veterans to see the fruits of their labors than doing it in real time locally. There are so many positions that are just occupied by, no offense to older people, but like old boomers who are just not, they don't have the energy. They don't really have a vision. They're just doing their civic duty, which I respect, but we need people with vision in those positions. We need veterans to go into their local parties and get involved, become a precinct captain, become the chair of your like county Republican Party or Democrats, if that's what your thing. But getting wielding some real power and making a real difference in the lives of the people around you. If you have vision, creating a bulwark against this nonsense that we're seeing emanating from DC, helping your community be more independent against these forces. I mean, there is no better fight than that. And veterans are so primed for this moment. I just don't like to see when guys get really discouraged and they start talking about holing up in their, you know what I mean? Like this whole thing, like I'm gonna stash my guns and ammo and gold and all. And I'm like, okay, that's great. But like, what did we learn from the military? Like, most of all, it wasn't just keep your rifle by your side. It was having a fire team. It was having a strong platoon. It was taking care of the guy next to you. You need to be taking care of the people next to you.
Blake
That
wrote a whole book about it. Build your network.
exactly.
Yeah,
Exactly. So yeah, that's kind of my little soapbox speech there, but I think veterans should be doing that. We would be so much better off getting good, upstanding guys and gals in their local political offices, making a real difference in their communities and being able to say no to this stuff. You know, everybody's upset about these things happening, but it's like, guys, like, what did we learn? Like, okay, I'm a private. I'm not a general, right? I can't do anything about the strategy in Afghanistan, but man, I can take care of the guys next to me. Man, I can take, you know, I can protect my fire base. I can do things. I can be good at what I do and protect the guys next to me. And in that way, we win.
Which is, you brought up something I thought was interesting. So it kind of leads me to my next question, which was, what did you think, if you haven't seen it already, but if you have, what do you think about the Boy Scouts changing their name?
Yeah, it was tough. I talked about this with
Were
my
you a
wife
scout
because
before?
I was an Eagle
Yeah.
Scout at
Okay.
14, actually.
Oh wow, man, look at you.
I was very motivated, man.
You came in you would have came in as an E3. Look at you.
I know. Well,
It's...
I was one of those weirdos who came in with a degree and then I was enlisted and everybody was like, dude,
wrong with
what were you
you?
thinking? And I was like,
Yeah.
well, I was, you know, I was pretty gung-ho when I came in.
Yeah, that's
But
cool.
yeah, you know, the scouts were, I grew up without a dad. And so scouting to me was like a lifeline. I loved it. I just relished it. And I had great scout masters. A lot of them were Vietnam veterans. They were just great people, man. I mean, I learned how to be a man, you know, like
Yeah.
I really, it helped this kid who shouldn't have had a chance, to kind of get on my feet and figure things out and be confident and like learn skills and, I love the outdoors and all those kinds of things were just perfect for a kid like me. And it just pains me that these organizations have really lost their mission. And I get it. They've been under immense pressure for decades now. And there have been internal problems, like, don't get me wrong, but it's like I just see this and I look at this generation of young boys, and there are things for girls too that I also it worries me. But it's like, man, like we owe these kids a better childhood. We owe them a better coming of age. Like we have lost that. And I worry about these young kids from Gen Alpha coming up. They need things like this. We owe it to them. This is what it is. Like, how are we going to have good Americans to solve the problems we constantly complain about if we're not preparing this upcoming generation to do that? And things like the scouting program did that. And so I would love to see, I have a project in the works right now. It's not going to solve the whole problem, right? But I am planning on making a move in this area because I'm passionate about it. And I really hope that we can take back a little part of the culture for our kids. And I'm committed to that. So I'll be kind of announcing something like that. I don't know. I kind of feel guilty using my platform to do it, but at the same time, like,
And
it's
you earned
because,
it. You do what you want with your platform. But
oh,
it's like,
well, I'm not in it to try to like, I'm not looking at this like an opportunity to aggrandize myself or make money. It's more like this is a passion project of mine. But I will be later this year, launching something that I hope will start to make a difference for some people. So,
good.
yeah.
Well, obviously, you already know. Let us know so we can help, obviously, right? And some of us are in the area, so we're ha happy to help, man. But that's great because
Appreciate that.
I think you also bring up a good point. And it kind of goes back to what I was thinking when I asked you about the draft. It's like this next generation, how tied in to the concept of the United States of America are they? And the reason I ask that is because, I already brought up my daughter, 18, graduating next week. She has a very specific understanding of what that means because both of her parents were military. Great stepfather who's also military. Like she's had that influence, right? So I don't worry about her. I don't worry about her stepsisters. I don't worry about any of that. I'm just curious more as to what we see playing out on campuses. I'm all like, hey, if you want to protest peacefully, got it. That's part of your right to assembly and all that great stuff. But it doesn't look like it's a pro-American protest, right? Like when you're doing the things that you're doing, when you're desecrating the monuments or the various items that are on campus because of your point of the day. To me, that's not American. To me, that's not bought into the concept of what this country is affording you to do, because there are still very few places that you can do what you're doing and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Be let out the very next day from jail, right? To have all these charges dropped. Like, you're exploiting a system now that's given you so many things that you claim to be against that you don't even realize until you take advantage of them. And then realize, oh, maybe they're not that bad because I can do this without any real repercussions.
Yeah.
And so that's what my concern is for the people coming up. Because I would say, like I said, the generation of my daughter is what it is. Who will her children be is my question. And that's who I'm concerned about.
Yeah.
Because we'll be grandparents one day, right? And it's like, okay, what do you know and understand about the concept of America where you're no longer being educated strictly by books? Now you're educated by social media. You're consuming everything but traditional media. You're getting all of your information from outside sources who may not have the best intentions in mind, right? You have so much to filter through. How does that form an American, a loyalty to America, I would say? How do you not think just in concept of I'm a global citizen without thinking first that no, actually you're an American?
I worry about this too. I mean, it's on top of my mind all the time. I would say a couple things. I think that this medium that we are part of, this, you know, this online social media slash new news environment that's really bringing down some of these old dinosaurs in the area, in the space, which should happen. You know, I think that outfits like the Washington Post and the New York Times have been overall a net negative for the American people. And I think we'll see that more and more as time progresses. But
well, they still have 50 million followers though, like on
Twitter. They do.
That's
do.
What I'm worried about.
But you know what? The narrative that they have controlled and dominated that has, it's no longer uncontested. It's challenged all the time.
Yeah.
And that is a very good thing. Now, obviously, within this platform, you're going to have a lot of nonsense. You're going to have a lot of hateful things that make people angry. And then you're going to have a lot of foreign influence. So those are also things that we all know about, and they will cause problems. But overall, we're seeing people at the same time being able to carve out autonomous information in a way, like havens. You know, like this is I don't want to say a safe space, but it's like you're able to create small networks of information that obviously the regime looks at as like a real bad thing, because they can't control it very well. I mean, they're trying obviously, but this is really good. And why it's good is because I do think that the powers that be are very anti-American as we understand it. I believe that they systematically vilify the American people. They, like I mentioned before, like with our foreign policy establishment, they take and take and take, and then put the blame on the very people that, the only people that succeeded in the mission that they gave them, you know? And so, like, I think that this ability to challenge that narrative, the ability to seek out other information, like the pandemic was a perfect example. If that had happened in 1950, there would have never really been much of a thing. I mean, people will say, oh yeah, you know, if this was in the past, we would have had this massive backlash. But like at the same time, all information was mostly controlled and it was almost uniform. And so I don't know if I would really say that the American people would have rejected it the way that we want to believe. But today we have different sources of information. We have different narratives. And one of those narratives that I really want to cultivate is a true and a real, almost mythical patriotism, where somebody can be critical of Washington and recognize that we've lost our freedoms in many ways, but at the same time still love this country and the people that they come from.
Yes.
Still have a loyalty to it and be able to have those two things at once. And I believe it can be done because I've seen veterans do it. veterans are able to do this. They're able to recognize all of the nonsense and the shenanigans and the betrayal, but at the same time still love the country and the people that they served, and to know that it is fundamentally good, not bad. America is good. We have a terrible government right now. We have awful leaders, but the American people then in and of themselves are good. You know, when the nation was attacked, whether they knew it or not, like all the details and all the, you know, all the shenanigans going on behind the curtain, but they yeah. still stepped up and put their yeah. skin in the game. Like, I respect and admire that. I met so many wonderful people when I served. I love the American people. So I want us to recover a truer patriotism that is not a bumper sticker, right? But is something deep, something that we all feel, and it connects us and it helps us bind together in this fight that we're in now to restore our freedom. And so I believe that this new environment that we live in, we have a lot more power than we realize. I mean, look at us. I mean, we're pushing a different narrative right now all the time. While we're on this social media. And yes, people will get like, well, what are you doing about it? And right, like, obviously it's important to get your skin in the game and in your neighborhood. And I'm always the kind of person that says people get involved and get involved with local politics and make a difference. But at the same time, there's still value to challenging these regime narratives. There's a value to restoring true patriotism. And I think our children and grandchildren will benefit from that. And I worry about these kids on college campuses. I mean, really, most of them are kind of like my enemy, the way I look at it, because I don't believe that they are. I believe many of them are, not all kids that go to college, but I'm saying the ones that are anti-American, that view me as a problem. They're not my friends. They're my enemy. And if they, you know, if they are put in charge of things, like, they're going, obviously I'm going to be their opposition, but I'm doing that because I love this country, and they are inimical to the country I love and to the interests of the people I care about. And so anyway, I think we can restore a real sense of true patriotism, and we can use these platforms to push that, and to kind of like, we have to move through that narrow passage, right? I don't like people that will say, you know, anybody who served was in the employ of these evil people, and they were just, you know, a mindless automaton, and they're bad, and, you know, they killed kids,
brown people, and yeah, of course.
I hate that. And I also don't like people that are blackpilling these young kids that might want to serve. Like, yes, I think you should be very well aware of what you're doing, and like, you should take that decision. But a kid who says he's going to go volunteer and like wants to go into Ranger Bat or something, like, I admire that still. And I encourage, you know, if that's what they want to do, do it. And I respect that. But we still need to push back against some of these people that are trying to make it seem like America is bad and Americans are stupid and Americans are worthless and helpless. I hate that. But on the other side, we also need to push against the people that are using power to destroy the America we love. We need to push back against the people that are trying to make America into something it should not become. And so I think we're fighting a very unique fight, but if we band together and stick together and we hold the line on what we know is right, and I think if we defend the country we love and the people we love, you know, in the long run, I think we can beat these guys.
Well, I mean, at the very least, the top's dying out, hopefully, right?
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Hate to end it on the ominous note, but it's true. Like, we're really, you did say one thing. I just want to get one last thought from you. You mentioned Trump before was an outsider. Do you think he still is? Do you think he has a path? And do you think RFK is the actual outsider, or is he just kind of a temporary nuisance until we get to November?
So I love what RFK sounds like. I sometimes wonder if he's being, I don't know, but I don't know. I'm just speculating. Sometimes I wonder, I like his rhetoric. He sounds like the way he sounds it reminds me of like an old America that was, that I love. Right. But I also think that he might be being used, and I don't know. We'll see. So and his policy positions are really problematic to me. So that's kind of I would never vote for him, but I will say, like, I do like his rhetoric. With Trump, though, I think Trump is a quintessential outsider. Now, the question for me with Trump is can Trump and will he take down this bureaucracy? Will he restore the consent of the governed to the American people? And I want to believe he will. I don't know though. But I'm not going to hold my breath. And that's sad to me. That's what I wanted from him in the beginning. I wanted to see him take a hatchet to the Civil Rights Acts. I wanted to see him take down the bureaucracy. I wanted to see him fire two-thirds of the intelligence community. I think that's at the very least some of the things we have to do if we want to get back our country. But will Trump do it? I mean, he's very old and I don't trust his judgment all the time, but in this race, I can't think of anybody else worth my vote except for him. He's the only person
Choice.
that I'm going to vote for. I mean, you know, and so I am going to support Trump. I'm going to vote for him. But I'm not going to, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to rein in my expectations a little bit. But I can't do another 4 years of this guy who's in the Oval Office now. I don't think I can afford it. But this guy in the Oval Office now is just, I mean, if he gets 4 more years, I can't even imagine what it will do to the country. So, yeah.
Do you
But
think he
I'm,
gets him?
what was that?
Do you think he gets him?
Well, I heard something that really like worried me the other day is that the FBI will not be investigating allegations of voter fraud, just voter suppression. And I thought that was a real, you know, that's a tell on how this is, you know, how they're going to approach this. Now, obviously, Trump can win if he can overcome the margin of fraud, right? And the shenanigans. I will say, I believe that the powers that be have a lot of influence and power, but I don't think they can completely fake a whole election. Okay. They can push things in the right direction, and there's an enforcement mechanism that they can either choose to use or not use. Obviously, that's that. But I mean, if things are bad enough, Trump can actually win. I don't think it's impossible for him to win. He could even win from jail at this rate,
That would be hilarious.
which would be hilarious and kind of deserved. So I just like deserved as in like Washington needs that message.
He
But
pardoned himself and then he walks out.
yeah, I mean, it's just, and I mean, it's so obvious what they're trying to do to this guy now. I mean, it's so shameless. I mean, how can people with a straight face, you know, call like say that this is the rule of law at play. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
It almost just it doesn't even seem real. Like it just seems like it's a TV show playing out at this point.
It does. And you know, at the very least, like I know people are critical of Trump, and I'm totally fine with that. Like if people don't really like it, I know there's a lot of DeSantis supporters out there, and I respect the reasons for I love DeSantis. I think he's done great. There's some things I don't agree with, but
Do I?
overall, I think he's been incredible. And really, he's been great. I would love to see him do some of those things at the national level. But I will say this about Trump. Trump, whether he meant to or not, he exposed these people in ways I don't know if anybody else could have. They came out of the woodwork and really showed their true colors, really showed where consent of the governed is. You know, like they've shown this whole thing to be a farce. And that's unsettling. But at the same time, I'm glad I know now. You know, I think Grandpa said this once on the timeline, and I love this. Like he said, I mean, I'm gonna butcher this, but it was basically like, Trump showed who hated me, like showed me who hated me. And
Yeah.
that's so true. You know, I didn't realize these people had so much animosity towards just normal people like me. And
Yeah.
so Trump came
That's
along,
true.
you know. So
No.
the Trump as even a destabilizing force, I think ultimately is a net good. So I'll be supporting him. But I'm not going to hold my breath. I'm going to be focusing on the local most. Most of my money, time, and attention will be
Yeah, I
here.
think that's it's for the best because people are going to put so much stock into this election, and I mean, most people one way or the other are going to be disappointed. So
Yeah.
it is what it is. You still got to get up the next day and go to work, right? And do what you
Yes.
got to do. So yeah. All right, that is the Lafayette Lee. You can find him on Twitter X at Partisan underscore O. He, as I said, has his own Substack. You can find him there at Lafayette Lee, and he is a contributing editor at IM 1776. Anything else you need to plug while you're here? Any good movies with your actor there that we should go check out?
I mean, Gone with the Wind's a classic. I
Gone with the
love
Wind is great.
The Misfits are great. You got to watch that one too.
Okay, The Misfits. So everyone go watch that when you sign up.
Marilyn Monroe, you can't go wrong.
Marilyn Monroe. Where have we gone to where we don't have Marilyn Monroe's anymore, do
No, we don't.
we?
Bring them back.
Sad. Trump's favorite line, sad. Yeah. So, all right. When you're done watching all of this podcast, go watch The Misfits and then find something with Marilyn Monroe in it. All right. All right, brother. I appreciate your time, man. Thank you.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Thanks, Eric.
You're welcome.